photographs and memories.
Hello, podcast listeners. This is Santa Fe Stories, and I'm your host, Nancy Udell. Today, we have an interview with Gay Block, renowned artist and photographer, about her life and work, and her recently published monograph about love. After the interview, Jim Atwood has a New Mexico Minute about some wacky goings-on in the southern part of our state. Stay tuned for that. At a couple places in the interview, you'll hear other audio. Those are clips from the films that Gay made, audio clips from those films, and those films also come with the book about love, which is her photographs and films, 1973 through 2011. Here's my interview with Gay.
Okay, Gay, thanks so much for coming. Gay Block, Santa Fe photographer. How do you describe yourself?
How do I describe myself as a photographer? That's an interesting question because I've also been a donor to things like institutions, like art institutions, and sometimes they have a hard time describing me as an artist, which is what I want to be described as, and as opposed to a donor. Also as a mother, and I don't so much describe myself as a lesbian, but, you know, that's the life I live. My work hasn't been a selling thing. I've shown in museums, and I did have one person show at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, but I've shown enough, and hasn't been my goal to show. It's been more my goal to find out what I needed to know, what I needed to learn. There were a lot of sort of holes in my self, is what I would, how I would say it, in terms of not knowing who I was, not being fully developed, and not having the kind of family life that engendered the love that made you know who you were. I thought of myself in a much darker light. I thought that photography was magic, and I loved taking pictures with my Brownie camera.
Oh, your Brownie camera.
And I took it to camp when I went to camp, and I photographed my mother. And these images of the family at home, I can't even believe how good they are, you know, from 12 years old.
Yeah.
But I never thought that I would know the secret of photography or what I considered the magic of photography, because girls weren't supposed to know anything. All you were supposed to do was get married and have children.
Mom was your first subject.
My mother was my first subject in terms of the first photography teacher saying, put film in your camera and photograph something you need to understand. And I didn't quite think I was ever going to understand my mother, but I found myself at her apartment the next morning, and she was on the phone and talking business, and she was nude, and I stood there for a while. And my mother didn't have any compunction about walking around nude. I mean, she didn't do it in front of males, I'm not saying, but anyway, and so I stood there for a while, and then I had my camera with me, this new camera with the first roll of Tri-X I ever put in it, and I took one picture, and she didn't even seem to notice, and then I took another picture, and then when she got off the phone, she started posing for me. So there were five precious negatives that I hid for, you know, I made some prints, but I didn't know what I was doing then, although I can see now that those pictures were perfectly composed. I mean, they were really, I had an eye. It was in me. I knew how to take pictures. Right. And I can see that from the 12-year-old pictures, too. And so my mother wasn't terribly the right person to be a mother. And so I've done a book about my mother before about love, so I think that had a lot to do with the shaping or the non-shaping of myself as a complete human being. I started looking at my mother and realized that the community in which they lived, you know, their friends, I had judgments about them, intolerance of their lives. They seemed to have forsaken the Jewish values. They were members of the Reform congregation, which was a very watered down form of Judaism. I knew, but I didn't know much about anything that was any more traditional at that time. And I realized that beginning to photograph my mother and then beginning to photograph her friends to try to understand what had created this family, this community. Why were these people's values the way they were?
Well, what were their values? What would you say? Well,
I would have to encapsulate it as monetary values. If they said the word Jewish, it was in a whisper. If they were out in
sotto
public,
voice,
yes, and they were very into assimilating. The very judgmental. The Eastern Europeans were not as, and the more traditional Jews were not as good as they were. And they went to parties and had maids and that raised their children, I being one of the children. So I was feeling very negative about them until I began to photograph them. And I honestly feel that I was also, even as I was photographing other people, I was photographing my mother. I was trying to figure out her and this community. Through these oral histories, I'm learning where they came from. The fears of being Jewish, the fears of not being able to be upwardly mobile in terms of their occupation because they were Jewish. I could understand how their values had developed into what they were. Feeling somewhat negative about them, perhaps I didn't think I was going to be able to take an open picture of them. When I came home and I looked at my negatives in my contact sheets, I realized that the tolerance I had learned at the interview showed in the photograph.
I'll also put a link to this book about your mom on the site. It's unique.
It is a unique book.
You called you referred to yourself as self-revealing, and I think this book about your mom certainly falls in that category, and I'll link to that as well. So when you first started doing the photographing, you were really feeling that these people are kind of phony or frauds, or you didn't relate to their values. And you started to kind of shift on that through the photography, which, you know, became a big part of your own growth. And that also led you to the Miami and the South Beach series, which I absolutely love. And at Radius Books, at the show there's some great pieces hanging in that series. Talk about that a little bit.
I loved working in Miami. I had never been to Miami when I went there in 1982 with my friend Debbie Friedman, who was doing a concert there. And driving down the South Beach on Ocean and Collins Avenue, I saw the old Jews sitting on the porches for the first time in front of those Deco hotels. And I thought, my, that is so amazing. I just couldn't wait to get out of the car and talk to them, and which is what we did that night after dinner. And it became a four-year project after that. I just kept going back and forth, long weekends or sometimes a little longer. I would stay in Miami and work there. And I loved the people, and I loved their Yiddish accents, which is why I made a film about them as well.
Florida prolonged my life. You live here. In New York, all you do is just think of your dad. I'm a grand-grandmother. I have a wonderful family. And I'm happy that I'm alive. And I still take care of myself. So I'm very happy. Every day that I'm on my life, I'm happy.
So it's not hard to be able to.
I should say not. Unless you can take care of yourself, then when you're a vegetable, then it's too bad. I wouldn't want to live that.
You live alone?
Yes. I have an apartment alone, and I have even a will that I want to die in dignity. I hope my wish will come through.
You've also got another book called Rescuers, Portraits of Moral Courage in the Holocaust, which was published in the early 90s?
92. Malka Drucker and I traveled through 8 countries interviewing over 100 people who were Christians who rescued Jews during the war. And it was an amazing thing to do. Those were people unlike you'd ever meet in your whole life. And taking up their picture, they look like old people. They were, you know, they were not old, but they were, you know, this was 1988, most of the 87 and 88.
Well, you've probably captured something that might have been one of the last chances to capture.
Yes. One of them just died. Tina Strobos just died this week. It was just in the New York Times yesterday or the day before that she had died.
So what countries did you interview again?
Well, we started in Israel, where Yad Vashem has been honoring the people since the 50s. You had to have had 2 eyewitness attestations in order to be honored at Yad Vashem. Then they, and you had to have not taken any money for what you did. And obviously you had to be non-Jewish.
We were sharing the bedroom, my father, me, and my little sister. And during the night I woke and I heard strange voices in the room. Father was talking to somebody in Polish. I said, to whom he's talking in Polish? To Christine or what? And I clearly, vividly remember how this man said, in Polish, professor, you know, I went to every friend's house, I knocked on every door, and I asked them to take me in, to hide me
for a few days.
Everybody closed the door, refused. I didn't want to come to your house. I know that you have a small child, but, you know, we want...
You are the last.
The last one to whom I come.
We went to Israel first, where there were over 30 of these people living. They had gone there with a person that they saved. And the reason that that happened was because Jews were being killed, but if you were a rescuer, you were also in danger. So they left and went to Israel, went into a DP camp often, but went into Israel.
What's
after
a DP
war.
Camp?
A displaced persons camp, oh. Which is where people who survived the concentration camps were until they were able to be placed in some country. This one woman, Gertruda Babalinska, she was a nanny in a Polish family, and the parents were taken. The mother said, would you please take care of Mickey, the child? She had Mickey living with her the rest of the war, Catholic woman. After the war, this Catholic woman goes to Israel she never learned Hebrew. She said, what was I doing in a Jewish country, you know, a Catholic woman? But she adored this child who very much treated her as his mother. Most fascinating story was of these 2 women we met in Marseille, and Ermine Orsi and Emily Gut. And they both worked and took Jews to this village in southern France called Le Chambon, which was honored by Yad Vashem as an entire village. And they saved 5,000 Jews. When we interviewed the 2 of them together, Ermine Orsi said, if it happened again, I wouldn't do it again because the Jews really haven't thanked me. You know, they never write me Christmas cards. And many of the people she had placed were children. And so one day in my studio after the book came out, there was a phone call from a young woman who said she was a religious school teacher in Boulder, Colorado, and they wanted to contact Madame Orsi. And it was about a year later that I got a letter from her explaining. She said, I took it into the religious school to my 5th grade class, and I started reading the stories to them. And when we got to Madame Orsi saying that she wouldn't do it again, the children were very distressed. Why would they not thank her? One of the children's grandfather had been in the Holocaust, and he came in and he explained, if you were a Jew in this time and you were rescued, even though you were as grateful as you could possibly be for someone for saving your life, to thank them, to think of them, meant you had to put yourself back in that time that was the most awful time you can imagine. And so for a lot of people, and especially children, especially parents who didn't want their children to think of that person who saved them as more important than their own parents. So he said, it is not necessarily just for the Jews that they saved to thank her. It is for all Jews, and in fact, perhaps for all humanity, to thank her. And the children said, well, we should thank her. So they each wrote a letter, wow, which this young woman translated into French, and they sent this package to her. And she wrote them back, and she said, you have rescued me. It is true that we all owe the rescuers for saving the face of humanity.
What's really interesting, I mean, you have so many other things you've done in your career. The couple projects we've talked about are just a few of them. And you've got this fantastic Camp Girls project where you photograph 26 years apart your daughter's camp classmates and then as grown women. And that's also at the show at Radius. And I encourage people to see that. I just want to go back and link this kind of ironic connection between your family and the blessing of having money, which was kind of your disdain of that originally got you into photography, but then that ended up, in a way, both supporting and changing your life in photography. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, of course, having money, that is being, having the resources I need to support myself without gainful employment, I would say it that way, and is, in terms of being an artist, is a blessing and a curse. I got to do exactly what I wanted to do and photograph the people I needed to photograph for my own purposes. And yet I didn't seek assignments to go, whether it would be for a magazine or whether it would be journalistic. I didn't do any of that kind of work. And I know that photographers who have done that, you know, going different places, it definitely influences your work, and you see things and you photograph more your own kind of things. But my life has been what it has been, and I have photographed the people I needed to photograph. But yes, the values that sort of what is the motivation for the beginning of my photographic work influenced my questioning and became the reason that I went to the summer camp in the first place to photograph. I had gone to that summer camp for my last year was 1956.
What was the name of the camp?
Pine Cliff.
Okay.
In Maine, Harrison, Maine.
And your daughter was there.
When it was 25 years later, my last year was 56. 25 years later was her last of 7 years at Pine Cliff, 8 weeks every summer, 7 years. She loved it. She had no negative feelings about it. And my life was sort of changing a little bit, and I wanted to find out, had I done something in sort of an injustice to her and put her in a situation for 7 summers with these privileged Jewish girls whose values I was wondering if they could have been any better than what I found in Houston among the moneyed people.
Your parents' friends.
That's right. But then when I got to the camp, all I thought about was what they looked like because they were so exquisite, you know, in their beauty and their girlishness or whatever. And so all I did was photograph. I didn't talk to them at all. So that's what made me want to go 25 years later. So this is from 1956 to 1981 to 2006. So it's 50 years photograph them again. I found Allison actually did the research for me, and
my daughter,
yes, and found the 65 of the women that I had photographed as girls, and I went to visit them and asked them these questions. The questions that I had were good questions, and there's still many of them the privileged girls that they were, as they're women now, 2.5 children. And when I talked to some of them and asked them about feminist movement and and spiritual things, if I asked those kinds of questions, it was very little even understanding or response to my question. You know, it just wasn't there, a part of their lives, many of them. And so I'm going to go back again in maybe 2 or 3 years.
Thanks so much, Gay.
Well,
this was great.
Thank you. It was very enjoyable for me. Thank you.
And now Jim Atwood has a New Mexico Minute on some very wacky goings-on in southern New Mexico. Hi, Jim.
Yes, some strange things happened in southern New Mexico on Tuesday in the elections, in 2 mayoral elections. First, in Sutherland Park, City Councilor David Salinas won election as mayor. You may remember a couple of weeks ago, he was arrested for extortion and blackmail. As city councilor, he and some of his cohorts arranged for a stripper to show up uninvited in the office of his opponent and do a striptease and lap dance, which was secretly recorded, videotaped. And then they tried to use the videotape to force this opponent out of the race. Despite the police work really uncovered this, and the evidence seems compelling, yet he was elected mayor by the wise citizens of Sutherland Park. Perhaps the good news is, as a condition of his bail, as he awaits trial for extortion, he's not allowed to go to City Hall or talk to any city workers. So maybe he won't be able to do too much damage as mayor. And then in Clovis, David Lansford was elected mayor. He had served as mayor for 12 years previously and took 4 years off for, I'll tell you in a moment, but then came back and was reelected as a mayor on Tuesday. During his off period, Lansford engaged in a series of bizarre campaigns against President Obama, calling him a monster, quote, the greatest evil ever known to mankind, surpassing, I guess, Mao, Hitler, Stalin, Uriah Heep. That's pretty good company there for Obama. And Lansford traveled to New York to participate in a mock trial of Obama, where he, Obama, was found guilty of sedition. Yet this fellow was elected, 63% of the voters elected him as the mayor again in Clovis. Rick Santorum, I think you found your New Mexico campaign manager. That's my New Mexico Minute.
That's it for Santa Fe Stories this week. Go to the website, santafe-stories.org, for more on Gay Block, some of her amazing images, and links to the newspaper articles Jim referred to. Don't forget to support our local papers. We'd be lost without them. Have a great week.